May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon. My name is Alan Sweepon, registration number 13491, and I represent the appellant Lynn Barrage. Your Honors, we believe that this case presents a unique issue. That is, specifically, whether a fee-shifting provision in a contract permits a court to award attorney's fees to a party who prevails on a tort-based claim when there is no finding that the contract was breached, and in fact, based upon the unique nature of this case, there can be and will be no such finding ever made. There is, obviously, I understand you've all read the briefs. The procedural history of this case is unusual, and specifically it's unusual because it involves actions in both the federal court as well as the state court. There was much discussion about that in both the opening brief and the answer brief as well as the reply brief. And obviously I'm not going to repeat it here. And one of the reasons why I'm not going to repeat it here is because I think a lot of that is really not that important, that germane to the issues in this case. There are a couple of important points I want to emphasize, however. The bankruptcy court, specifically Judge Sid Brooks, heard the evidence over a multi-day hearing and found that Ms. Barrage did not prove the necessary elements of fraud in order to have the discharge of Ms. Wolf denied. Instead of making a determination regarding whether or not there was an entitlement to attorney's fees by any party, what he did was he sent the case back to the state court to make that determination. That was based upon the United States Supreme Court case of Stern versus Marshall, which is a long, somewhat convoluted case. I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, and I'm going to attempt to get into it. But basically, as I understand it, what it said was that the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court is limited to just certain core issues, and Judge Brooks felt that the issue of attorney's fees was not a core issue. There was, of course, pending in the state court at the time a construction defect action, which had been stayed actually for a couple of years pending the bankruptcy, but that action no longer involved Ms. Wolfert or any of her entities. The state court, the problem with this case, and we think what leads to some of the problems here, Your Honor, is that the state court had no involvement in the bankruptcy court proceedings. The state court heard none of the evidence, and in fact didn't consider or rule on any of the motions. But because Ms. Wolf now had her discharge, because Ms. Mirage's claim had been denied, the issue of whether or not she breached the contract was never going to be decided by any court. So what happened was the state court, relying, we believe, on insufficient information, simply awarded attorney's fees in favor of Ms. Wolf. There's also a lot of arguments in the briefs regarding whether or not this case or factual situations similar to this case are ever going to arise again. We say it might as a result of Stern versus Marshall. The appellees claim it won't, or it's unlikely to happen again. Again, Your Honor, we think a lot of that is completely irrelevant. In fact, if this case had remained in the state court, in the bankruptcy court, and Judge Brooks had awarded attorney's fees, we'd probably be having the same arguments, although we would be having it obviously in the federal court before the federal district court or before the 10th Circuit.
Well, Mr. Sweetbaum, I wonder if you would have, because I've read the transcript, a part of the transcript of that proceeding, and in that proceeding, your client was seeking attorney fees under the fee-shifting provision, the very same one at issue here, and in fact testified, pursuant to counsel's questioning, that he considered the dispute to be under the contract for purposes of that provision.
That's correct.
So you're taking an inconsistent position.
Well, we are taking, that's fair to say, Your Honor, we are taking an inconsistent position. And that, of course, was argued extensively in the briefs, the issue of whether, of what relevance it was that Ms. Barrage testified that if she prevailed, excuse me, I've got a cold, that if she prevailed she would be entitled to attorney's fees. It's our position that her testimony, her argument, is simply not relevant, Your Honor. It's nothing more than an argument. In fact, either the bankruptcy court or the state court or this court who has to decide based upon the law, not based upon Ms. Mirage's testimony, whether or not there's an entitlement to attorney's fees.
Now, but it wasn't just her. It was counsel taking a position as well, including in the trial management order in the bankruptcy court, seeking attorney fees under the fee shifting provision. Isn't it some kind of invited error or judicial estoppel or something like that?
Well, I don't believe it's an invited error. If there was invited error, it would be before the bankruptcy court. The argument was never made before Judge Hoke in the state court. In fact, Judge Hoke, I'm not even sure, was made aware of those arguments, except to the extent that they were raised by Ms. Wolf. But again, Your Honor, it's our position that that's nothing more than an argument. I will concede to you, because I really don't have any other choice, that in fact it is inconsistent that that counsel, someone different than me, made an argument that Ms. Mirage testified that they believed that they were entitled to attorney's fees. But again, that's nothing more than an argument. It is in fact a legal issue that has to be decided by a court, presumably by this court, as to whether or not there is an entitlement to attorney's fees. If in fact it was Ms. Mirage who prevailed in the action, Your Honor, and then she asked for attorney's fees, simply because she made the argument, that would not be a reason for granting attorney's fees. I'm trying to take the reverse position, and I think the reverse would not be true. And as a result, the position taken by Ms. Mirage in the bankruptcy court was also not true.
Counsel, let me turn your attention to the merits of the case. What do you do with the relating to language in the real estate contract?
And Your Honor, I think that's really the thrust of this case, is whether or not the court was justified in awarding attorney's fees on basically a tort-based claim based upon a contract provision, a fee-shifting provision in the contract that in fact uses the words related to. We have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor.
Does one of your responses include the estate of Gaddis case that was decided by another division?
I can't answer that question right now. I don't know. But here's what I can tell you. If you look specifically at the fee shifting provision in this contract, which is cited in the brief, it's paragraph 20 of the contract, and specifically that section is called time of the essence, default, and remedies. And what it says after referring to earnest money and other payments not made, that then it goes on to say, if any other obligation hereunder is not performed, or waived as herein provided, there shall be the following remedies. And then there is a section A, buyers in default, section B, the sellers in default, and a section C, which is where the attorney's fees provision is found. And Your Honor, one of the problems with this is that we have never had a finding about whether or not Ms. Mirage didn't perform her obligations under the contract. That's sort of central to this whole issue. One of the arguments that we tried to focus on in our briefs was that what's unique about this case, what's different than the other cases cited in the Appley's brief, is that in those cases where you have attorney's fees that are awarded based upon something other than the contract claim, there is a finding or there's some determination, sometimes there's a judgment, that there is liability under the contract.
That's not always true. That's not always true. We have a case from a division of this court in 1989, Sperry versus Bolas, remarkably similar to this case. The property owner's fraudulent misrepresentation claim was held to have arisen from the contract, the real estate contract, and therefore subject to the fee shifting provision. Are you aware of that case?
I'm sure I have read it. I cannot recall the facts of it as I sit here, Your Honor.
All right. Well, there was no finding of breach of contract in that case either. And in the Bedard case, which you do deal with, the distinction you're trying to draw was not the basis upon which the court ruled. The court held that all the claims, including the tort claims, arose out of the contract.
I'm sorry, was that the Bedard case?
Bedard case.
Yes, I actually remember the Bedard case, and that was one of the cases that was dealt with in the briefs. And Your Honor, as I recall, the Bedard case was a case having to do with a deed and breach of warranties in a deed, if I'm remembering it correctly. And as I recall, it was a motion to dismiss that was granted by the plaintiff. And as a result, I think all of the claims, including warranty claims, contract claims, and tort claims, were all basically decided for the prevailing party. And I think that's, again, what makes the distinct, what makes
those
cases.
But that wasn't what the court said it was hinging its ruling on. The court said the tort claims were covered because they arose out of the contract.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I understand that language is broader than the distinction that I am trying to make here. But I think if you look at the facts of that case, it is, in fact, distinguishable from the facts of our particular case, where we have not only no finding of a breach of contract, we have Judge Brooks making statements, which obviously are dicta because it wasn't the issue in the case, which basically said Ms. Wolf did in fact breach the contract. So we have an unusual and I think an inequitable situation where we have a party to a contract who essentially is a breaching party, or at least there will never be a finding because of her discharge, yet she is entitled to attorney's fees from the other side because Ms. Mirage here did not meet her burden on the tort claims. And so I would argue a couple of things. Now, number one, there's a distinction between this case and the facts of the Bedard case. I would also argue that the particular language of this fee-shifting provision is not broad enough to encompass this particular situation for the reasons that I was just saying. If you look at the introductory language to the fee shifting provision, it talks about obligations that are not performed, and I think, Your Honor, that's what we believe is a distinction of the case. Does that answer your question?
And just to be clear, you're not familiar with the Gaddis case, which also involved a tort claim.
Not as I sit here, Your Honor. I'm sure I have read it. I'm sure. I don't recall whether it was cited.
That's a recent case. I think it was August of this year, something about that.
I can't say that I'm familiar with it. I am familiar with the Bedard case because that is obviously extensively discussed in the briefs. Your Honor, I've got 2.5 minutes. If you have no further questions, I would like to reserve my last 2.5 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Catherine Hopping. My attorney registration number is 35036. I represent Cameron Wolf. Raj's primary argument is that attorney fees are not recoverable because the adversary proceeding involved only tort claims and not a breach of contract claim. And we've just heard Mr. Sweetbaum discuss that somewhat. And what I'd like to note, though, before I get into that, is it's telling what Ms. Mirage is not arguing. Ms. Mirage is not arguing that attorney's fees are not recoverable under 11 U.S.C. 523 in an adversary proceeding. That's because attorney's fees are recoverable in an adversary proceeding. Both the United States Supreme Court and Colorado Bankruptcy Courts have established that attorney's fees are recoverable in an adversary proceeding if you could prove the same elements in a state court claim. And the only question then that need be asked is whether the prevailing party could have recovered fees on those same fraud claims in the state court, and the answer is yes. Ms. Mirage had the same claims for misrepresentation and non-disclosure in both the adversary proceeding and the state court construction defect action. If either party had prevailed in these identical claims for misrepresentation or non-disclosure brought in the construction defect action in state court, that party would have been entitled to fees under the contract. Mr. Sweetbaum has just discussed the contract, and Section 20 of the contract is just as Mr. Sweetbaum said that it was. And in Section 20, and I'd like to talk about the introductory portion that Mr. Sweetbaum brought up, because his interpretation, Ms. Mirage's interpretation of this introductory section, if his interpretation is true, it's nonsensical. It means that only a party that establishes a breach of the contract is entitled to fees. That would render it a one-way attorney's fees provision. It would not be a prevailing party provision, and it wouldn't entitle a party that defended an action successfully to fees. Because what he's saying, and it states time is of the essence, if any note or check received as earnest money hereunder or any other payment due hereunder is not paid, honored, or tendered when due, or if any other obligation hereunder is not performed or waived as herein provided, then there shall be the following remedies. And it goes through those things. Well, what Mr. Sweepon, what Ms. Mirage is asserting is that Ms. Wolf failed in her obligations under Section 10 of this contract to provide a seller's property disclosure form filled out to the best of her then current knowledge. That is a requirement under Section 10 of the contract. Absent that requirement of Section 10, seller's property disclosure form is not required at all. And if Ms. Mirage was correct that Ms. Wolf had failed to disclose things that she knew about in that seller's property disclosure form, or intentionally concealed information that she knew, defects that she knew in that seller's property disclosure form, that would have been a breach of Section 10 of the contract, period. And so what this introduction to Section 20 of the contract for attorney's fees and costs says is that if an obligation hereunder is not performed and an action is brought, then the prevailing party is entitled to attorney's fees. Well, Ms. Mirage said an obligation under the contract wasn't performed. She said that you didn't fulfill your obligation under Section 10 to fill out a seller's property disclosure form to the best of your then current knowledge. She brought that claim. She brought it in state court. And when Ms. Wolf filed for bankruptcy, this matter went to the bankruptcy court. Ms. Mirage exercised her right to file an adversary proceeding objecting to discharge based on fraud, and she lost. There is no dispute that the seller's property disclosure form is directly related to the contract. There is no dispute that Ms. Wolf, that the adversary proceeding involved claims related to the contract. There is no dispute that Ms. Wolf was the prevailing party, and there is no dispute that she's entitled to her fees. There was some discussion regarding cases such as Bedard, also in the briefs, is another case called Meadow Homes. And, you know, those cases, I think, speak for themselves. And I have Bedard here, the exact language out of Bedard. The court states, although asserted under various theories, all of Bedard's claims against Ms. Martin arose from the sale of the property. Meadow Homes has very similar language. Meadow Homes involved the right to bonds, and the court in Meadow Homes held that the right to those bonds originated in the agreement. That's similar to what we have here. The obligation to fill out the seller's property disclosure form originated in the contract.
Counsel, let's take a hypothetical. Let's say that instead of a claim like that, the claim had been one that there was fraudulent inducement to enter into the contract. Okay, so you have a different kind of fraud here. You have a pre-contractual fraud as opposed to a fraud in the performance, if you will, of a contractual obligation. Would this relating to provision apply given the introductory language?
I think in that situation you'd have more of an argument that it's a stretch. If you have an argument that that you should have never even entered into the agreement in the first place. I mean, in that event, if there's a finding that you should have never even entered into the agreement in the first place, then arguably that contractual provision would not apply. In this case, these claims are related directly to the obligations of the contract after it's signed in performance of the contract. So I think you'd have a different scenario if it's a pre-contractual duty inducing you to enter into it as opposed to once you've signed it, now you have obligations that are set forth due to the contract. Yes, Your Honor. You look like you want to ask me a question.
I do want to ask you a question and break my otherwise, you know, silence. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you is, in applying this provision, does it matter that a party invoked a procedural mechanism that limited or precluded the other party's ability to bring contract claims?
I don't believe so.
Why?
Because I think that the relating to language encompasses both breach of contract claims and tort claims. I don't think it didn't say, and there are cases that talk about, you know, that they would, the attorney's fees provision, the prevailing party's attorney's fees provision would not apply in certain situations that arose other than for a breach of this contract. And you can draft that kind of language specifically.
No, I understand that. I understand that tort claims can relate to things like that. But should the clause be applied where the other party has initiated litigation on contract and tort claims and yet been precluded from proceeding on the contract claims because of the procedural mechanism that was invoked, I call it procedural mechanism, the bankruptcy proceeding, invoked by your client?
I don't believe so. It still relates to the contract.
It relates
and it still
to the
relates
contract.
To the performance of the contract.
It does relate to the contract, but what about this particular argument of counsel that it's inequitable? It's inequitable to essentially reward a potential wrongdoer because, as I understood the breach of contract, it wasn't just the failure to file an accurate disclosure statement. I thought the breach of contract was there's all kinds of deficiencies in the performance of the contract itself.
I don't believe that there were any deficiencies in the performance of the contract.
Were there alleged to have been deficiencies in the performance of the contract?
Not that I'm aware of. No, the contract closed, and Ms. Mirage owned the home for a couple years
right.
until the defects were found. So I don't know that the performance of the contract was necessarily an issue.
And so in the state court complaint, it was limited simply to the failure to file the disclosure form.
Well, it was related specifically to construction defects that were found subsequent to the closure.
So that's perhaps a little broader than the failure to provide an accurate disclosure form.
Yeah, and in all fairness, there were two real issues concerning the failure to disclose. One was failure to disclose in the seller's property disclosure form. The other was there was an inspection done by Mrs. Mirage personal inspectors. They had written Ms. Wolf a letter saying, here's everything that was on the inspection that came back. We need you to fix these items. Ms. Wolf wrote back a response letter that said, here are the things that I'm going to correct. Here's the things I'm not going to correct. And so there was a claim both that she failed to disclose items in the seller's property disclosure form, as well as failing to correct things that she said that she had corrected in the response letter concerning the inspection. So, but you know, to just wrap up your question, I don't believe that there is an inequity. I think that Ms. Mirage brought an adversary proceeding asserting a fraud claim under a contract that had a prevailing party's fee, and she lost.
So she took her risk.
She took her risk. She understood, and this leads to another point, which is a point that was brought up in the briefs, alleging that the parties didn't understand that when they executed a contract in 2006 that they could be held liable for fees for an adversary proceeding that was filed years later. But the reality is Ms. Mirage always wanted her fees. Ms. Mirage asserted those fees under identical claims under the same contract starting in 2008 when she filed a state court action, and she continued to assert those fees in the adversary proceeding when she filed that action, understanding and knowing that it's a prevailing party's attorney's fees, that she takes the risk that if she goes into the adversary proceeding and loses, and I did try that case. I was the one asking her questions as she held the contract in her hands and testified, yes, this is a proceeding that I believe falls under the guise of this contract, and I am seeking my fees under this contract. I mean, that was her testimony in response to questioning by her own counsel and in response to direct questioning by myself. And so to make the argument that this was a factual argument that was concocted by Mirage just on her own as she was sitting on the stand is false, because these were questions that were propounded directly by her own attorney in an effort to assert their position that attorney's fees were recoverable in that adversary proceeding.
Were these positions that were taken in the adversary proceeding with respect to the attorney fees, were they also brought to the attention of the state district court that ruled upon this request for attorney fees?
Absolutely. And that was all part of the motions and the filing for attorney's fees that went to the district court at the time that this got handed down from Judge Brooks back down to Judge Hope. And let me just say quickly, because I only have a few more minutes, you know, one of the arguments that Mr. Sweetbaum and Ms. Mirage is making in this case is that the district court, because it did not sit in the position of the judge during the adversary proceeding, didn't have in front of it all of the information that it needed in order to make an accurate decision in this case. But The appellants had the opportunity to give the district court whatever information that it wanted. It opted against giving them an entire transcript of the adversary proceeding, and Ms. Mirage didn't give the entire transcript to the district court judge for a reason, because they lost. It did not look pretty, and that case, the state court construction defect litigation, was still pending in front of Judge Hoke at the time. And so there were things that came out in that transcript, and there were positions that were taken that probably Ms. Mirage didn't want the judge that was presiding over her state court litigation to see.
Was the position about Ms. Mirage thinking the attorney fees were awardable under the contract, was that brought before state district court?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. I quoted that extensively. In the way that I quoted it for you in my answer brief, just the exact transcript quoted, I quoted the exact same way to the district court. So the district court had the understanding at the time that it read those briefs that Ms. Mirage had gotten on the stand under oath and testified that that was a proceeding in which she believed that the contract applied and was seeking fees under the contract. There was some discussion about this case presenting a unique situation in light of Stern. And honestly, Stern dealt with a bunch of jurisdictional issues that I'm also not a bankruptcy attorney, and so I can't speak to a lot of those issues, but I know that a lot of those issues are still being sorted out. I don't think that those are issues that can be sorted out here or by this court. I think that that's something that's going to happen somewhere else, but I do think that it doesn't take away from the fact that Judge Brooks did what he thought was most economical. He recognized this as a state law claim, and because this was a case that was also had same parties pending in the state court, he did what he thought was judicious and sent it back down, because it was a state law claim, to Judge Hoke. And I don't think that it creates a unique position at all. I think it's a very straightforward state law contract claim. I think that the bankruptcy proceeding and the fact that it came from there makes it look a little bit different, but it's really just a diversion, that it really has no effect on anything.
Well, we don't have a claim before us that we lack jurisdiction, do
nope,
we?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
That issue was never raised. I think, and I'll just end by saying, I think what's interesting is that on the one hand, Ms. Mirage argues that the contract was never mentioned, was not at issue, and that there's no support in the record that the parties intended the contract to be applicable to the adversary proceeding. But when confronted with their own client's own testimony that the contract applied to the adversary proceeding and that the fees were awardable under that contract, that direct testimony is suddenly meaningless. It's just factual testimony that doesn't mean anything. The fact of the matter is Ms. Mirage wanted the contract to apply, wanted its provisions to apply, but when the adversary proceeding went badly for her, she changed her mind.
Counsel, you're out of time.
Thank you.
In my 2 minutes and 22 seconds, just to clarify something in response to some answer to a question asked by Judge Daly. In the state court proceeding, there were many, many claims. There were negligence claims, there were fraud claims, there were negligent misrepresentation claims, there were breach of contract claims, and it had to do with a lot more than simply the disclosures and whether they were accurate and some of the communications that happened between the attorneys before the property was purchased. In fact, this case had to do with a construction defect action where essentially Ms. Mirage was arguing that the house was uninhabitable. And although it happened after we filed a brief, the case did settle on the eve of the September trial, and it settled for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Well, that's not really relevant.
I understand, Your Honor. But in fact, it is accurate that when the bankruptcy was filed on the eve of the trial and when the When the adversary proceeding was commenced by Ms. Mirage, having to do with the discharge, she was limited to what claims and what arguments she could make. And it had to do with fraud, specifically under the specific section of the bankruptcy code. She was precluded from bringing any actions regarding breach of contract that she otherwise would have been able to bring in the state court. And I think that is relevant.
But counsel, that fraud claim, at least in part, dealt with the property disclosure provision in the real estate contract.
It did in part. Absolutely. There's no question about it. But, Your Honor, I think it had to do with more than that. And I think, by the way, one of the issues that's in dispute in this case was whether or not the claim in bankruptcy court just had to do with the disclosures. And it had to do with more than the disclosures. It had to do with all sorts of issues that are basically akin to common law fraud.
Counsel, what about opposing counsel's assertion that kind of like, listen, in going into the adversary proceeding, you took a gamble and took a risk, you know, that if losing, you'd be on the bag or on the hold for the attorney fees. I just took up 20 seconds of his time, Judge. Could I ask you to give him 20 seconds?
Sure. So your question is, isn't it true that Ms. Mirage took a risk by basically bringing the adversary proceeding? And obviously she took a risk that she was going to lose. And she did make the argument that she was entitled to attorney's fees, which we think is a legal issue. It has nothing to do with what she or her counsel believed. But the risk with that was that she was going to lose, not necessarily that this attorney's fees provision would apply. We don't think it does apply as a legal matter. We think it's simply inequitable and unfair to apply the case where it was Ms. Wolf who was the wrongdoer in this case, yet it's Ms. Mirage who needs to pay the attorney's fees. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.